to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Sovereign Canada. I'm Mike McCullough, broadcasting on CIVL, syndicated on campus and community radio stations across the country, and recorded on the shared, unceded, and traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Today on the show, we'll examine how Canadian political leaders and diplomats have pivoted from calling Trump's threats to Canadian sovereignty jokes to stone-cold serious.
You start seeing it spreading, and that's when it stops being Trump being Trump, and that's when it starts being, oh my God, this discussion is actually happening in wider circles.
Yeah, that's Sabine Nolke, and she returns to offer her insights from the outside looking in, relying on her expertise in international law and peace after 3 decades working for Global Affairs Canada. Then, after a Vancouver woman, Jasmine Mooney, was detained by border agents in San Diego and held for 2 weeks, we'll get legal advice from a professor at the Allard School of Law at the University of British Columbia.
There are many more powers in immigration law than we see on display most of the time. And you just need to be careful about it and make sure that you understand the migration status that you have.
Dr. Catherine Deverne also advocates that it's well past due for Canada to review its Safe Third Country Agreement with the States. And as Canadians go to the polls on April 28th, I'll chat with Ted Craig from Fair Vote Canada, who continues to push for electoral reform.
It's really a switch to proportional representation, and in a nutshell, that means the percentage of votes should be as close as possible to the percentage of seats.
That's all ahead on this edition of Sovereign Canada. Canadian brass, including diplomats, to the most recent former and current prime ministers, are all in alignment when it comes to the Trumpian threat to Canada. When Trump first started making 51st state and Governor Justin Trudeau comments in late November of last year, the then prime minister and his cabinet referred to the comments as jokes. But quickly, politicians began to see these comments as more than jokes, more than attempts to get Canada to beef up border security, more than getting Canada to stop the move of fentanyl or to increase military spending. Fast forward to March 4th, when Trump's tariffs first went into effect, and speaking to the country, then Prime Minister Trudeau called the tariffs part of a trade war and said Trump wants, quote, a total collapse of the Canadian economy because that will make it easier to annex us. Foreign Minister Melanie Joly has also been clear-eyed in saying in U.S. media, quote, when President Trump speaks, we take him at his word, and now calls the fentanyl rationale a, quote, bogus argument. Canada's ambassador to the United Nations as well, Bob Rae, he calls Trump's threats about, quote, a colossal land, water, and resource grab by force, end quote. And current Prime Minister Mark Carney, in his announcement to call a snap election, said Trump, quote, wants to break us so America can own us. Joining us now to help to understand how Global Affairs Canada and political leaders alike are able to pivot from calling these threats just Trump jokes to concerns over fentanyl and finally legitimate threats against our sovereignty is Sabine Nolke, Canada's former ambassador to the Netherlands and a visiting fellow at Western University in London, Ontario, in the Western Academy for Advanced Research on the topic of international law and peace. Thanks for joining us once again here on Sovereign Canada, Sabine.
You're very welcome, Mike. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I guess I'll have to call you now a friend of the show. Is this your second appearance with us? So First off, can you explain then how can Canada appear to be able to pivot like this on the world stage to be able to call these threats what they are?
Well, it's a careful calculus that you have to make as a diplomat, and including at the very highest policy-making level, i.e. in cabinet. And what you need to weigh is the impact of your words on the Canadian public. So that is difficult. I'm sure Prime Minister Trudeau wasn't laughing when he returned from the dinner table in Mar-a-Lago. We cast them as jokes to turn them into jokes, to give And I would assume that this would have been a discussion. I don't know. I wasn't privy to them. But when you hear something like that, you try to say, okay, if it becomes public, how do we cast it? If you can cast it as a joke, then people aren't too worried. And you give your opponent, your adversary, the maker of the quote-unquote joke, a face-saving way out. He could have said, yeah, of course, I was just joking. But then it gets repeated over and over again. I would assume that the decision to spend $1.5 billion on strengthening the border in response to, you know, the allegations about fentanyl, we knew that they were bogus. I mean, it's obvious if you look at the numbers, the amount of fentanyl that went into the U.S. from Canada in 2024 fit in the suitcase. And so it's not a real threat. But, you know, strengthening the border when your southern neighbor is starting to make noises about wanting to take you over is probably not a bad idea. So I would assume that a fair number of the $1.5 billion is not being spent looking at the Canadian border going south, but at the southern border going north. It's dual use border strengthening. That's what I assumed at the time was happening, frankly. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's also part of the discussion. Again, I'm not in there. I'm just reading tea leaves here. Now, in terms of the diplomatic pivot, I think things really shifted on January 7th. And that is before Trump took office. He went on an interview, and I referenced that in my article in The Conversation, where he said to the interviewer, I can't remember right now who he was speaking with, the interviewer asked him, you know, are you going to take over Canada by force? And he said, economic force. And that really, coming up with that answer so quickly and so straightforwardly, I think that was a signal. And then, of course, when he took office, he followed that up. The second part of, you know, taking this threat more seriously and feeling the need to pivot is that the words about, you know, Canada 51st state started to spread, and they were started to be used by congressmen, Republicans as well. So you start seeing it spreading, and that's when it stops being Trump. And that's when it starts being, oh my God, this discussion is actually happening in US circles, in wider circles. So then the government needs to make an assessment. Do we freak everybody out and call it out? Or do we play along and look like we're just rolling over and, you know, not taking it seriously? And frankly, I'm very glad that they did start taking it seriously publicly when they did. Part of the reason why I wrote the article that I did in early February was because I was afraid that it wasn't being taken seriously enough. And I really wanted to wake people up, because language matters. And particularly in diplomacy, and when you can hear the same phrases repeated over and over again, that's because the person who utters these phrases wants them to become a reality. That is the construct that we have in diplomacy and in politics as well.
And that's part of the reason why on this show, I try not to frame it as how Trump frames it, but instead as a threat to Canadian sovereignty, because that's truly yes. What it is, right? And so do you think when Canada began updating the way they posture on this, that you kind of touched on it a bit, do you think that this was in an effort to galvanize Canadians against this, but also perhaps to bring together the world stage, both in the U.S. and internationally, beyond the shores of the U.S.?
Both. As well as waking up Americans, because the American public, I think we know, is one of the least informed, you know, in the Western world. They're very divided in terms of their consumption of news and media. And you have to penetrate not just the public, but also the body politic in the United States. And to some extent, it has worked. I mean, you will have seen the news about some of the state houses starting to pass resolutions about how much they value Canada as a partner, as a sovereign partner. And so it is working. You know, we need to make everybody aware. Trump ran three times on you know, being the guy who brought peace, and I'm the peace guy, and you know, no wars on my watch. And yet he's using this language about annexation. Now he's trying to cast it as a non-bloody annexation through economic force, but either way, it's a violation of international law. It is a threat to international peace and security, and economic coercion is coercion. So, so we need to really respond appropriately and wake the American people up to what their president is actually doing, so that when the chips fall eventually, hopefully they will say no.
Yeah, and it does seem to be working. I'm even seeing the Canadian flag now being used as a symbol of resistance in the States.
Yes. I mean, it's a fact that our economies and our societies are interwoven. My daughter-in-law is American. You know, we have family on both sides of the border. We go shopping on both sides of the border, or we did. I think few of us do these days. But, you know, it's North America is already a partnership. You know, we don't need to be annexed in order to contribute to America's well-being, economic well-being, social well-being, etc. But of course, Trump doesn't see that. He sees our resources, you know, and that's what it is about. It's about water, it's about energy, it's about minerals. And somebody got into his brain, and I think it's probably a combination of Elon Musk and Vladimir Putin, because as I've pointed out in my article, and Evan Dyer has pointed out, Greg Sargent, formerly of the Washington Post, has pointed out that the language Trump uses vis-a-vis Canada literally mirrors that which Putin used prior to his invasion of Ukraine. So there is a pattern here. And we really need to wake up both Canadians, Americans, and the rest of the world. I mean, what happens if we have to invoke Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty? You know, you need to pave the ground for these sort of things. You need to pave the ground, perhaps, for a General Assembly resolution condemning that kind of language and that kind of rhetoric in international relations.
I've wondered if Trump pulling this stuff, especially with regard to Greenland, because it's a smaller plot of land to take, and Denmark perhaps is not as close to the United States. I've wondered if it's a test case to basically see if NATO can withstand somebody within it going after another member.
Well, yes, that could be very well, but it could also be providing him with a reason to pull out of NATO. You know, I'm pretty sure that one of the reasons why Canada hasn't, in the North Atlantic Council at this point, raised Article 4 of the NATO treaty, which says basically we're going to not threaten each other. You know, we're going to be friendly in our relations with each other and supportive and blah, blah, blah. I'm sure the reason we haven't raised that, because it would be give him his own personal little version of the Reichstag fire and good reason to pull out.
Yeah, so diplomacy is often looking for where are the off-ramps, and also what on-ramps are we providing if we do such and such a thing down the road?
That's correct. Yes, there's a lot of what I said at the beginning. You have to really weigh the impact of it is that you're doing in the long term. Trump doesn't do that. You know, he's incapable of looking past people saying no to him immediately. But in real life out there, everybody else understands that words matter, actions matter, and you want to make sure that you don't throw babies out with bathwater and you don't create worse problems than you already have.
And so on that note, what would your advice be to whomever becomes prime minister after April 28th in Canada?
Well, keep the pressure on. The economic retaliation needs to go on. I think it's already being felt in some of the states. You will recall back in Trump's first term when he insisted we renegotiate NAFTA. We negotiated with him, Chris Jeffreyland negotiated with Washington, but we also had a huge diplomatic effort with the states. And that will be where the effort will lie, is individual states that have benefited from Canadian exports and from imports, as you know, exports to Canada, imports from Canada. States like Michigan, where the auto industry heavily depends on parts being provided by us, the construction industry that needs our lumber and our aluminum. So that's where the diplomacy is. You never in diplomacy have just one target of a, you know, attack, if I may use that word, use it advisedly. You have to broaden your support before you go for the one who has the holds the pen. So that's what we would be doing, and I'm sure that is what's happening right now. When you listen to our ambassador in Washington, Kirsten Hillman, who's on a brilliant, brilliant public relations campaign, but also is speaking to governors and to, you know, state authorities, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I will foresee happening, is that we will try and broaden our support so that Trump himself gets to be under pressure, not just by us, because that he will dismiss, but from his own people.
And I think a part of that is, have you noticed the billboard campaign that Canada launched in red states? What do you think about that?
I think it's pretty good. I think it's again, it's awareness raising. You know, the American public is so ill-informed. And the ones who get all their news from Fox need to see alternative news sources. And if we have to bring it directly to them, then so be it. That's what we have to do. Although I have to say that even on Fox News, some of the hosts are beginning to get a little bit antsy about what the administration is doing, because you can feel the public support waning as it hits people, even the people that voted for Trump, you know. Because again, he doesn't think in terms of actually providing good things for society. He doesn't think in those terms. So when he his policies right now are all about retribution and pressure, and you know, putting the civil service in trauma. But that has a roll-on effect on the population at large. And once they start feeling that, I think the tides are already shifting. And we have to help that along a bit.
So that's part of the pressure campaign inside the United States that we're obviously taking part in. Do you believe that global affairs is reaching out beyond, like we just saw Mark Carney in France and then in the United Kingdom for his first foreign trip, which is itself a break. Usually prime ministers visit the United States, from what I understand, for their first foreign trip. I believe that that's part of bridge building on the foreign side of things, in case that we no longer can rely on an ally like the United States. Do you think that that our diplomats and political leaders are preparing for a world in which we're jettisoned from the U.S. sphere of influence?
Yes. If we don't, we're being silly. Yes, absolutely. I mean, even if the U.S. doesn't follow through on Trump's threats, what they have proven is through the existence of someone like Trump that they're no longer reliable. That, I mean, Biden was a welcome respite, but that only lasted 4 years. So if you can only rely on the United States in 4-year chunks, then you can't rely on them at all. So we have to build our alliances elsewhere. We have to build our economic capabilities up to ensure that we don't rely on the United States as our biggest purchaser and supplier. I mean, you mentioned Carney's trip to Paris and London. His first phone call was, his first phone call was to Ursula von der Leyen. You know, so
the EU.
So rapprochement with the European Union is an absolute must for us economically and politically. Rapprochement, I think, with some of our Latin American partners as well. I mean, Canada is, I think, at least when I left Global Affairs, we were the country with the most free trade agreements, bilateral free trade agreements of any country. And I think that will continue. You know, we have to modulate our politics vis-a-vis China. I think China is happy at this point to put as much pressure on us as they want, because, again, it's to their advantage as well if NATO frays. So we really need to look to Europe.
Hmm. And I guess the big question on many people's mind is, can we even really truly call the United States an ally anymore? I mean, a lot of people, individuals, certainly don't feel like that government has our backs. I wonder if inside the halls of global affairs and so forth, if it's being framed in this way, we have to prepare for them to no longer be an ally at this point. What do you think about that?
Yeah, if I think we would be wandering around with blinders on if we didn't prepare for a paradigmatic shift in Canada's position. I mean, I'm not privy to the discussion, so I can only guess. But yes, I mean, alliance building outside the United States, I think, would probably be the number one diplomatic priority at this point. Looking to see where the United States can hurt us, frankly, and preparing for that. I mean, it's not just NATO, it's NORAD, it's there are other agreements. We have the bilateral boundary agreements that have been in place for 100 years on how to manage the Great Lakes, you know, and Trump has already threatened to pull out of those. He has zero interest in climate change. I mean, frankly, if you look at the way climate change is evolving, Canada will become more arable. You know, our growing season will extend. So not only will we have energy and water when water is going to become scarce, particularly the way the United States is depleting its aquifer to water its golf courses in the Southwest, we will be the food basket for the world, you know, which makes us more attractive to be taken over by the U.S., I should think. But it also makes us economically more viable.
So then I guess that raises the question of, is 2% GDP even enough for a NATO-committed partner
no.
like Canada?
No. No, it's not. And, I mean, I'm not a military strategist, so, you know, I'm pulling these ideas really out of my hat, essentially, but I've been observing things for a while. The big thing that I think our military at this point is thinking, must be thinking about, how to strategically defend a country the size of Canada. You know, all our population is, or the vast majority of our population, is within 200 kilometers of the United States. But all our wealth is in the North. How do you secure the North? So I certainly agree with Prime Minister Carney that we do need to secure the Arctic. We need to build those bases, but we also need to really have a political plan in place as to what to do with those bases when we have them. What do we do when the American submarines start going through the Northwest Passage, which is internal Canadian waters, a fact that the United States has never acknowledged, even under previous benign administrations. They say it's international waters. So what do you do when that sub comes? You know, I mean, those are really big questions with enormous consequences that I'm sure that are already being mooted and discussed in various skiffs around Ottawa.
Is there anything, Sabine, that you'd like to add that I haven't thought to query?
No, I think I've probably said enough. Canadians need to be ready. They need to think about how the future may unfold. They need to be ready to tighten their belts under the tariffs and not fall for efforts like the ones that Poilievre is undertaking already, where he looks at macroeconomic developments around the globe and blames political parties. You know, that's tearing us apart. I mean, those are issues that the country faces as a whole. And I would really want to stress the need not to domestically politicize international developments, because I think that's a huge mistake that would not help us in the future.
And where can folks find you should they like to follow you or learn more?
Well, I'm on Substack. My Substack is Canuck21, but you can also find me by Googling my name. My name is on the account. I'm on LinkedIn. And I'm on Blue Sky.
And a special thank you to Sabine Nolke. And I want to briefly highlight a recent story she published on her Substack titled They Lied to Us, The Story of My Family Under Fascism. It's worth the read. And coming up after a quick break, we'll have a chat with Dr. Catherine Deverne, a professor at the Allard School of Law at the University of British Columbia, about what Canadians should be aware of when crossing the border to live, work, or play in the United States during this time of immigration and customs enforcement crackdowns. Stick around. After having her visa revoked months earlier by U.S. border guards, Canadian woman Jasmine Mooney found herself detained at the southern border while entering San Diego. She says she was in the process of obtaining a new work permit. Mooney was then held by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in privately run facilities for 2 weeks in conditions that Mooney has described to ABC as inhumane. In an article Mooney penned for The Guardian, she says she was stuck in a freezing cell with fluorescent lights that were always left on, given foil blankets, water that she felt was unsafe to drink, and food that she says made her feel sick. Mooney also describes being shackled and repeatedly transferred from facility to facility. This is one example of a wider crackdown on immigration in the U.S., which has seen green card-holding Columbia University student-turned-protest organizer Mahmoud Khalil disappeared into detention, and the Trump administration's roundup of Venezuelans that the U.S. government has labeled gang members without due process and shipped to an El Salvadoran forced labor prison. Joining me to discuss what Canadians should be aware of when living, working, or playing in the U.S. is a professor at the Allard School of Law at the University of British Columbia. She's an expert in migration law, with her research touching areas relating to refugee, immigration, and citizenship law, and is the author of the book Making People Illegal: What Globalization Means for Migration and Law. Welcome, Dr. Catherine Deverne.
Hello, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today. As a professor, I was wondering if you could sort of, what kind of advice would you give to Canadians living and working in the United States? What should they be aware of?
Well, I think at the biggest headline level, the thing to be aware of is that there are many more powers in immigration law than we see on display most of the time. And you just need to be careful about it and make sure that you understand the migration status that you have, like understand the basis of your right to visit or remain in the United States and comply with the law. And I think also, this sounds really silly, but so many people recount stories of saying something deceptive at the border. Because it's just easier, you know, you're going to a conference, it's easier to say that you're a tourist because tourism permission to get into the United States is pretty easy. But it's worthwhile just remembering that lying to a border official when you're entering any country, the U.S. or Canada, is actually criminalized, and that it is a time when you really want to be complying with the law, and most Canadians visiting the United States will find that really quite easy to do. But it's clear that the American administration is going to have a really heightened approach to immigration enforcement at the moment.
And I think you kind of touched on it a little bit there. Like, not everybody who goes to the United States for work has proper work visas, because maybe they work for an international company, for example, that they're stationed in Canada, but say they have meetings in the U.S. So what would you advise folks like that who are flying into the U.S. for a weekend of business meetings? Should those folks be concerned that they could be rounded up?
Well, I think that's highly unlikely. And some people can, there are some categories of workers who don't need a work visa to work in the United States. But if you're going to the United States and you're getting paid by an organization in the United States, you should check into the basis on which they're paying you before you go and make sure you understand that. And it's just a time when I think people should make sure they've done their own due diligence about their permissions and their rights. And if you're not certain if your employer's done that due diligence for you, then take a couple of moments to check it out on your own. You want to make sure that you're not in breach of the law. Like most of the stories that we hear about in the press, and let's just leave using a 200-year-old law to try and deport people aside for the moment. But most of the other stories that are being reported right now are enforcement of regular laws on the